Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. This week, the season of debates has finally come to its merciful end, with Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton and her Republican counterpart Donald Trump doing battle in Las Vegas, Nevada. And the emerging headline from the final head-to-head tilt is that Donald Trump doesn't seem to be planning for a peaceful transition of power, refusing to promise to accept the result of the election. And that should pose a threat to our democracy at all, right? Well, for all the attention that Trump gets whenever he goes out of his way to deform our democratic norms, it's worth asking ourselves how our civic foundation has come to be so rickety that a glorified reality television huckster can so readily endanger it. Joining us to discuss whether or not there was some notable rot in our foundations that we should have noted much sooner is Rolling Stone columnist and author Matt Taibbi. Finally, for all you history dorks out there, we have a special treat for you. Today, author and historian John Cooper Miller Jr. is on the show. Miller is best known for his 2009 biography of President Woodrow Wilson. He joins us today to examine some of the historical roots of the Democratic Party and how it may inform its future. I'm Jason Linkins with Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, and Lauren Weber. And here's what happened first. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to So That Happened, your weekly podcast in which we describe how we are trapped in the belly of a terrible machine and the machine is bleeding to death. My name is Jason Lucas. I'm the editor of Eat the Press at the Huffington Post, and joining me is our good friends, one bad hombre, Zach Carter.
Woof.
And a nasty woman, Lauren Weber.
I'll take it as a compliment.
You should.
I should.
These are compliments. Bad Hombres and Nasty Women is one of David Bowie's lesser works, to be honest with you. So last night we had the final presidential debate, perhaps of all time.
This is probably it.
Perhaps
democracy is done.
And you know, it was in Las Vegas. We should be starting with like a cool gambling lead, right? The stakes were high.
I feel like I pulled the lever and nothing came out.
I got rich doing something stupid.
Yes.
Oh, no, I got poor doing something stupid.
Yeah, basically. So it was, so last night, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton teed off on each other for what seemingly will be the last time. You never know. There's a non-zero chance of anything this election. But I have to say, obviously, the big headline news of the coming out of the debate is that Trump doesn't necessarily plan on accepting the results of the coming election.
You know, I used to say, gosh, guys, there's only 19 days left until the election's over. And then I realized this all could break out on election day.
Yeah, hundreds of days more.
So outside of just, you know, the back and forth of debate analysis, where I think it's pretty clear that Clinton just mopped the floor with him after beating him to a bloody pulp rhetorically, and frankly, emasculating him in front of everybody. We as a country are still faced with the fact that this ridiculous movement that Donald Trump has built is not just going to go away when he's done being a president or presidential candidate. Dear God, I can't believe I had a slip of the tongue there about him being president.
That was truly disturbing, Zach.
And him talking about, you know, potentially refusing to acknowledge the results of the democratic process, and his surrogates going around, his son talking about how there are 4 million dead people on the voter rolls afterwards. This is really bad news, because the anger and anxiety that exists out there that is fueling the Trump campaign, that doesn't just disappear because they're like, oh, Well, Hillary Clinton won, so I guess I'm not going to be mad anymore. And if you've got somebody who's demagoguing this, this is how things get really, really, really bad. I'm not saying that they're going to like overthrow the government, but that is a way to build an anti-democratic movement in the country, and that is like a historically bad thing to be talking about.
What happens though if Donald Trump is not, you know, every day at the front of this movement, holding rallies?
Well, but what makes you think he wouldn't be?
Because it's a lot of work for no payoff. I don't think Donald Trump does anything for no payoff. I think he probably really does legitimately want to start some sort of TV network. And at that point, you know, it could be kind of like an outlet, an Avignon presidency for this group of people.
But he would just have like racist cooking shows.
Had like a version of it last night on his Facebook Live.
Yeah, dude. I mean, I think that one of the if you want to talk about that being a worry, I think you should think about who fills that void if Trump isn't there. Because I think Trump can only take it so far because he's a complete buffoon. Yeah. And eventually he gets found out by everybody for being a fraudster and a buffoon. It's really just only a matter of time.
Well, and look, there are a lot of fraudsters and buffoons who have latched on to the Trump phenomenon, right? Like, you know, Milo Yiannopoulos, who is just this complete, like, asshole clown who has made a career out of saying that he's into Trump and it's like his punk, performance art thing. I think there are a lot of people who are smart enough to realize that Trump has actually tapped into something that is out there in the American public, who are not as stupid as Donald Trump is, and who are capable of demagoguing the way he is demagogued, but demagoguing more effectively for a general audience. And I think the country's got to be really careful the next few years to keep that in check. And there aren't a whole lot of great solutions out there. I think obviously you have to do something to keep economic anxiety in check. You need to make sure that people aren't looking for outlets for their rage about like not being able to get a job and stuff. But a lot of this stuff is already baked into the cake. I mean, we've had 30 years of both racist demagoguery from the Republican Party and also frankly, bipartisan economic platform that leaves out a lot of the country. And if that's going to be hard to undo. And it makes me feel very worried about the next 5 years.
You feel worried?
Well, now I do. This has been such an uplifting time here on the podcast.
Thanks. Have you not listened to us? We're rarely, if ever, uplifting. It's like not a thing we do.
Zach basically just told us we're all screwed for the next whenever, and God help us if we ever get to another presidential debate. But
in a fascist way as well. But look, let's talk about the fun stuff. Fun stuff was the debate where Donald Trump did a lot of horrible things again, aside from maybe, you know, throwing out the democratic process. He just got his ass kicked.
He just also like he just wasn't able to talk about any of these issues succinctly or intelligently. I mean, his commentary on abortion was, I mean, I can't imagine how appalling that was for his evangelical base. I just did not feel like that was at all a decent enough proof that he's pro-life. It just wasn't.
One of the things that I saw someone remark on last night, and it's I think it's the story of this election, is have you ever seen a presidential candidate like put so little effort and thought into his candidacy? There is,
seriously though,
like what's really remarkable about the sort of like recent history of the Trump campaign is that for a brief mad moment, it looked like there was an opportunity for him to close a deal. The polls had tightened. Hillary Clinton had been through a couple bad news cycles. And as the debates began to unfold, there was like a real opportunity for perhaps Donald Trump to submerge his worser instincts and become, you know, someone who is willing to talk about policy, talk about, you know, his vision for America.
With a vision, with an underlying vision. Yeah.
And I think when you think about it, really, we're talking about three 90-minute periods of his life that he would have to get through and show some competence. The expectations have been set so low that just minimum competence would have probably boosted him in the media's eyes. But this guy is not interested in talking about policy. At a moment where he should be sharpening his message, describing the kind of laws he would prefer to enact, he's bringing Barack Obama's half-brother to the debate. You know,
it's just so much reality show jokes.
Barack Obama's.
Like,
I'm trying to imagine the political professional who said, what we really need to do to break through right now is bring this like weird half brother of Barack Obama to the debate?
Who's supporting you?
Well, why should we do that? He was like, hey, we just should do it. We just because reasons. You know, Barack Obama's not on the ballot.
I think you got to remember that this is a guy who hired Steve Bannon, who is the head of Breitbart News, which is this sort of reality-free, borderline white nationalist publication. And, you know, a guy who names someone like that for their campaign manager is not just doing it because the guy is good at right-wing propaganda. He's doing it because he thinks this guy has, a pretty good idea of how the public works. And I don't think... What worries me, you know, getting back to being depressed, is that, like...
That didn't last.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the fun stuff.
Here we
go. 2 minutes of that. We're back to it again.
I think that the guys who are advising him are people who don't actually care about winning elections. They care about blowing up the system for white nationalists. And this is a serious problem. And they have a media outlet, and they have one terrible political figure, but they're going to find somebody else. So I think that's what's happening with the advice. But you also look at what happened in the Republican debates, because Donald Trump wasn't prepared for the Republican debates. He just...
It was easier to mask because he was just blowing up at all the candidates on the stage.
And all the candidates were terrible, right? Yeah. We had
low energy Jeb and word salad Ben Carson.
Right. I mean, we forgot that Ben Carson is a guy who was selling fake herbal remedies saying they would cure cancer and stuff. He's a pitch man for that. And then who lied about it and said he never had anything to do with this.
He also
stabbed
someone
thing.
Sometime. I don't know. You know.
Right, right. This is a guy there was a controversy in the Republican primary where Ben Carson was insisting that he had tried to stab someone, and his Republican opponents were saying, no, you never tried to stab that guy. that's crazy.
I just want to make the message clear. I did try to stab somebody in the dick. All these people are lying.
Honestly, though, don't we all wish for those days? Don't we wish for those days?
We do kind of wish for those days, but...
But that's how he got out of the debates, was by doing this alpha male primate dominance shit to these other Republicans. And what was remarkable to me on Wednesday night was that Hillary Clinton came out and she just basically alpha'd him into the ground. I mean, if you wanted to, who was the tough badass on stage all night?
It was 100% her.
It was always Hillary Clinton. She looked like she had her shit together. She knew what she was talking about, and she did not have the time of day for this clown on the other side of the stage. That is a hard thing to pull off as a woman. Not that I have experience with this, but women politicians are constantly talking about how they've got to dance around being able to just dominate somebody else like that. And I just thought she completely emasculated him. Beat him at his own game.
Well, I thought it was the most policy focused. Honestly, I thought Chris Wallace did a great job.
He was a more worthy adversary.
He was
Trump
a more
was.
Worthy, you know. Yeah. And the conversation was there was actual substantive talk. I mean, instead of you know just pacing around the stage and weird lurking moments, there was Ken Bone. Yes. There was actually conversation about things that I cared about.
And Chris Wallace went to some deep cuts too. I mean, I think that
he did.
Had real
he did
command of the issues. I think the liberals don't like to give people from Fox News a lot of credit. But
I thought he did great.
I've watched Chris Wallace do his job at Fox News Sunday for 6 or 7 years now. And he's got a few blind spots. Like, don't ever ask him to interview Dick Cheney. He just loves Dick Cheney too fucking much to ever be credulous about it. But Chris Wallace does a really good job, and he's a really good debate moderator. He's done primary debates in the past two cycles. He's quite good. And what's interesting about Chris Wallace is that the moment some conservative thinks, oh, I'm chummy with this guy, he cuts that guy in the ass. You know, he's tough. He's
he
tough.
Went after Trump. I mean, I thought he was brutal. And
after all that talk about him saying, I wouldn't truth squad, as soon as Trump opened the door
God.
To the Trump Foundation.
Talk about lowering expectations for a debate moderator.
Yeah. Yeah, Chris Wallace is good.
He played the game.
Yeah.
He's the best Sunday show host. I know that's a low bar, but he is.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen John Dickerson, and I tend to think that John is a quality host, so I can't really judge. But back when I was watching the Sunday shows on the regular, he was easily the best. I mean, we're talking about it is a low bar. It was
right. Those are David Gregory
Dave
days.
Dave Gregory and George Stephanopoulos, which are frickin' frack right there.
Also, can we just talk for a second about how the campaign manager for the Trump campaign made a joke about the bad hombres tweet? Did you see that?
Kellyanne Conway.
Yeah, she was like, that wasn't me. Is she trying to get out of this? What is this?
Let's just be clear, in case you have not heard, I mean, Donald Trump said when he was talking about immigration policy that we have some bad hombres out there.
Yeah.
And that was racist and bad.
Some bad hombres.
Some bad hombres. You can't say that.
Here's the thing about Kellyanne Conway is that...
Is she just like running as fast as she can?
Most of America is getting to know Kellyanne Conway for the first time now because she's on the Trump campaign.
Yeah.
Prior to being on the Trump campaign, she was actually a very, very credible person in politics and ran a very successful polling operation. And the fact that she's now, I think, culturally tied to the Trump campaign is enormously bad for her because she's had to say and do things that I don't think she actually believes. And I think she's going to come to rue getting in bed.
I think she already is.
Metaphorically with Trump. And like you said, she's starting to kind of pull away.
I mean, I saw her interviewed after the second debate and they're like, why do you support Trump? And literally the best thing she could come up with is because of the Supreme Court justices that he could nominate. That's like the only thing that you can come up with as someone's campaign manager.
Because I signed a contract and it's too late. That's why.
So bad. Like, that's like the party line people give when they
Republicans
hate Donald Trump, but have to have to vote party line. Like,
Republicans would support a sentient bowl of milk if it would appoint strict constitutional constructionists to the Supreme Court. That's a very low bar.
I know. Look,
she's not the only person who's been damaged
by
this.
Away.
I mean, we look at Paul Ryan, who has had a meteoric rise, really, to being the leading Republican in Congress, frankly, as a Speaker of the House, controls the largest block of Republicans, will probably still be Speaker of the House after the election unless Clinton really, really trounces Trump.
Shellacks him.
Which is possible. It's not out of the question. But likely, Paul Ryan will still be around. This man built his whole career on being the reasonable, smart guy who only cares about policy and just wants to make sure the numbers add up.
And is somewhat folksy.
Yeah, and is friendly and has this nice smile and these pretty blue eyes. And
they are gorgeous.
They are. And
once had a beard.
It was a good beard, too.
It was a great beard.
But aside from all of this, he is now the guy who, like, wouldn't denounce Trump. And he's the guy who, you know, had planned a rally with Trump until the freaking tape came out about Trump saying, like, bragging about sexual assault. It was obvious that Trump was terrible and Paul Ryan wouldn't distance himself from it. And I think it's emblematic of a problem within the Republican Party, that it's a party that is built around favors for the rich that needs to get some kind of coalition together of people who are not rich to vote for the things that the rich people want. And it has fallen apart because the people who they've signed up for the movement, turns out they don't really care about the favors for the rich anymore. And Donald Trump has made all of the sort of the deal makers like Paul Ryan look like idiots. He's destroyed Paul Ryan's career. That guy is never going to be taken seriously as just the smart, reasonable budget guy again.
I mean, that was always kind of the radical promise of the Trump campaign. That's one promise he kept, is that he, like, fucked up the Republican establishment status quo.
Yeah, I mean, that's completely destroyed. I mean, the Republican Party, as we know it, is completely destroyed. I mean, I don't even have any idea what will rise from the ashes of this campaign.
Well, I mean, theoretically, it could be some more reasonable Reformicon type of Republican Party.
You're such an optimist.
I think we're headed towards a schism. I don't know. I mean,
I think that's obvious too. And we have a de facto Republican in exile running on the West Coast, and Evan McMullen potentially winning Utah. I mean, the schism is already sort of unfolding. It's beginning. And it's not just Paul Ryan. I mean, so many people got in bed with Donald Trump, and they'll be tainted forever
by the association.
Chris Christie, his political career is
over.
Fucking over, man. I mean, not only – and he's been trying to pull away from Donald Trump, too. The other day, they were like, what is about this campaign you're proud of? And he said, well, I'm proud of everything I said during the campaign.
Are you, though?
I was like,
are
really?
You, though, Chris Christie? Because you said some stuff.
Right. Were you proud of when you fetched
hamburgers?
Remember
when you were a hostage and your wife was also equally unhappy to be up there? Because that's what I remember.
I mean, he's been just – His extent to which public esteem for him has fallen in New Jersey, it's been so vast and so fast that it's almost hard to imagine. But Ted Cruz, remember, totally fucked this shit up.
Who cares? Everybody hates Ted Cruz. I'm fine with him going down in a blur of glory.
And also remember that that Christie signing up with the Trump campaign was a great way to distract from the fact that there is a giant criminal investigation into his administration for just creating traffic jams for no reason.
Right. For spite.
That's one of the real tragedies of the 2016 campaign is that it has deflected attention from one of the dumbest, most idiotic and hilarious political scandals of all time, which is Bridgegate.
Yeah.
And so I think it speaks to, you know, a year and a half ago, there was all this talk about how there's no Democratic bench and the Republican bench is so deep. Look how good all these people are.
Yeah.
Give me a break.
They got swamped. I mean, we talked this time last year, we were still talking about how deep the Republican. No, maybe not this time last year.
I mean, this time last year, we were watching like Chris Christie take down Marco Rubio in that debate. And it was beautiful. It was the robot commentary.
Yeah. Yeah, I believed in the Republican bench, too, and I was wrong. I was wrong about so many things.
One last thing before we go. Voter fraud. Okay, I want to make a real clear distinction to people, for people here. There's a huge difference between voter fraud and voter registration fraud, okay?
That's true.
If you register somebody who is not eligible to vote, you're not supposed to do that. It's a no-no, but it's not that big a deal because if you were, say, Acorn, Republicans used to go nuts about Acorn, this anti-poverty group. Because their volunteers would register like Mickey Mouse to vote. And the thing is, when you register Mickey Mouse to vote, no giant talking mouse shows up at the polls to try to vote as Mickey Mouse.
Right.
Okay? There's no way for that to actually turn into voter fraud where someone is trying to vote when they do not have the eligibility to vote. So when the Trump campaign goes around saying that there are 4 million dead people on the voter rolls and that there's massive fraud and this thing could happen, that they are being ridiculous. And I also want to point out that 4 million is about 1% of the United States population. And Trump is down by about 10 points right now. So even if there was a massive conspiracy to get 4 million people to vote illegally, there's no way it would tilt the election.
Also, I just want to point out that a massive conspiracy to get 4 million people to vote in an election would be so enormously difficult to pull off. The chance that one of those 4 million people would let slip, hey, I'm part of a massive criminal conspiracy, is like so, so likely.
So high. There's no way.
And the penalties for coordinating any amount of voter fraud, and I'm talking about like 2 or 3 people, are so severe.
As they should be.
That you would not in your right mind do this as a plan. There are so many better ways to influence elections. The best way is to just be fucking rich,
or just be friends, or just be friends with Putin. You know,
right? Like, it's the most circuitous way to trying to affect the outcome of an election. Rig up a voter fraud game. You know, just find a billionaire. Get you a billionaire who can do it all.
Yep.
That's my advice.
We need a billionaire for this podcast.
We do. If you're a billionaire out there and you'd like to support a podcast,
that'd be us.
Please give me a call.
You can also just support me.
Yeah, I'd be happy.
We refuse to sell out to your dumbass, but give us money. What are you doing with that money? Fast money should stay fast. So very quickly, send us a check. Okay. Lauren and Zach, thank you for joining us. It's the last debate, guys.
Possibly ever.
Bon voyage.
We have a very good show. Matt Taibbi is here, so please hang out and listen.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
And we're back. I'm Zach Carter, and I am joined on the phone today by Rolling Stone journalist extraordinaire Matt Taibbi. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you've got a big piece out on some guy who's running for president. I don't know if people have heard about this, but he's a real estate developer. Donald Trump apparently has been campaigning for like a year. Who knew?
I'm sure I'm like everybody else, and I can't wait until this is over and we don't have to hear about him.
Yeah, I guess we have like a little under 3 weeks to go. But until then, we can keep torturing ourselves with this stuff. I mean, I thought people have talked a lot about what Trump's candidacy means for the Republican Party. I thought your piece was a really thoughtful look at what it means for the state of American democracy more broadly. Can you just talk about that a little bit for our listeners?
Sure. One of the things that I always try to get at when I talk about Trump is, because what's happened, I think, a lot in the summer, and this is sort of what one of the things that happens with all American presidential elections, is that we end up with this choice A versus choice B, and one side decides choice B is bad, and that's all you ever hear is choice B is bad. Now, in Trump's case, it's true, but nobody's owning what, the whole country had a role in creating the preconditions for this to happen. And what I was just trying to get at was the people who are voting for Donald Trump are making this very extreme choice because they don't feel like they have any other choices. They feel dispossessed by the Republican Party and lied to. And if you go far enough back, some of them were also Democrats once upon a time and made the switch ages ago when they felt that the Democrats were no longer the party of working people. So I was just trying to get at the fact that these are people who are making an extreme choice because they feel like they have no political power and they just want everybody who's involved in the system, including people like us in the press, who are perceived as part of the whole, oligarchical, power. Mm-hmm. They want us all to have a comeuppance, and that's what the Trump thing is all about.
When you attended a couple of different rallies, one in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, another one in Wisconsin. I mean, what did you see at these places? What sort of things were Trump supporters telling you that gave you this kind of impression?
Well, I've been following Trump since the beginning of the campaign trail, on and off. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, I would say his crowds were a little bit more diverse in the beginning. They're pretty much entirely white now. Depending on where he is, I went to one of his rallies in Iowa not long ago where it was pretty much entirely white people over 60, and a lot of ex-military types, people who'd served their country and felt betrayed and they want, Trump to stick it to the man, basically. In Wilkes-Barre, it was a much younger crowd. This is an area that's had a little bit of white supremacy kind of flirtations. Yeah. There was a Klan leafleting there recently, and that was a much younger crowd. They were very, very aggressive. A lot of incredibly profane signage and conspiratorial thinking. But if you talk to people in line, which I did, extensively, they'll all say the same thing. It just keeps coming back to the fact that no matter how bad Trump is, no matter how much he sucks, he's not part of the system, and that's why they are voting for him. And they distrust both parties to that extent, and which is really remarkable. People really need to think about what that means,
Right, because it's not like they don't know about the problems with Trump's past. Even if you are sort of like this, fascist, semi-fascist enthusiast, it's not like he's a particularly competent one. You make that point repeatedly in your article that like this guy is totally screwing it up, and people can see that. I think it's Benji Sarlin for NBC had done some reporting about the way that the sort of Trump supporters have changed over time. That actually really early in his primary. The issue people talked about most was actually campaign finance spending when they identified as Trump supporters, and I feel like that's totally been like, that is definitely not something you hear about discussed with the phenomenon anymore. It's always about race and demagoguing immigrants and Muslims and, you know, all the rest of it.
Yeah, with a little bit of a subtext of anti-globalism too. I mean, a lot of people, if you talk to these crowds, I would say one in five people that you talk to will bring up Brexit, which is surprising because, you know, how many Americans really care about what goes on in the rest of the world, and especially from this group. But they feel some solidarity there with that decision. And that is not an uncomplicated decision that, you know, that went on in Brexit. I mean, a lot of people pitched it as a pure xenophobia, anti-immigrant vote. It was that, but it, you know, it had some other elements too that are similar to what's going on here. You know, people feel like they are being asked to worry about the you know, level of poverty and in places like India and China at the expense of their own economic well-being, and they'll talk about that and they'll say, "That's not my problem. Why did I sign up for that?" You know, and they're pissed about it.
Now, you mentioned in your piece, you talk about, you know, the emails that have come out from Hillary Clinton, the basket of deplorables comment, things like that. I mean, what do you think the Democratic Party needs to do to prevent things like this happening again in the future? I mean, the Republican Party, I think people have gone over its failures 1,000 times. But I feel like when I watch the Democrats, it just seems to me like the reaction is to point at Trump and say he's bad, point at his supporters and say they're bad. We're the good people, so we can move on. But what do you think needs to happen there?
Well, I think that's a very good point, and it's a very dangerous moment for the Democrats. And I was trying to make that point, which is that if you draw the lesson from this Trump affair that you're safe politically, and you know you don't need to reform yourself because the Republicans are in such a state of collapse and schism, they've radicalized to such a degree that all you really have to do is run against them forever, especially if the Trumpite wing, you know, continues to dominate on that side. Mm. But the Democrats have almost equally serious problems. I mean, I think the Bernie Sanders campaign really represented, especially among young voters, this feeling that their leaders are not in touch with them. And they're not in touch with their concerns. And that I think is it wasn't a scandal in the WikiLeaks dump, especially about the speeches, mm-hmm. but it was very revealing. You know, here's the real Hillary Clinton talking openly and honestly and thoughtfully about the future, but she's doing it with Lloyd Blankfein.
Right.
And she can't do it with voters, and that's a serious problem. You know, I mean, it's something we can litigate after the election, obviously, but the Democrats have to figure that out because that's not going to work going forward.
Yeah, and it's not just a question of you know what policies she's going to endorse. Although obviously that will be really important for the country, but you can just see she seems very very comfortable with a super elite crowd, and when she's campaigning, she doesn't always appear to be comfortable with, you know, the voters out there, which is true for the Democrats. I mean, it's been true for a long time. And I think if you go back, I mean, you can go back to the Bill Clinton presidency, that the Democratic strategy is always to point at the Republicans and say, what are you going to do? Vote for them. Look how terrible they are. And for 30 years, they keep getting worse. So the argument, you know, the argument improves, but the country deteriorates.
Right. Yeah. No, but you can't do that forever. That's the whole point. I mean, eventually it's going to come out of your support among young people. They're going to lose support among, you know, African-American voters, Hispanic voters. I mean, they have to deliver eventually, you know,
right.
And they haven't really been upfront with their constituents about what their economic plan is. They've just been running against Trump the whole year. And, I don't know. I mean, I think of stories like this Dakota Access Pipeline story, right, that's mm-hmm. coming out now. And this is a classic example. You have to choose what side you're on in issues. You can't have it both ways. So, and, you know, you're, mm-hmm. you're either on the side of the pipeline company or you're on the side of the people who are trying to prevent the pipeline from happening. And
right.
this repeats itself all over politics. You're either on the side of the big, expensive company that gives a lot of money and donations, or you're on the side of people. And very often it's as simple as that, and they tend to make the money choice, and that's the problem.
Yeah, and people can tell.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Even if they don't know exactly how, you know, that's what happens when you become too intimate with people like that. You start to see the world through their point of view. And I think that's the dangerous thing about the, you know, those Lloyd Blankfein tapes, is you see that shared perspective.
The stuff that makes me optimistic is the fact that Democrats at least got a very public wake-up call from the Bernie Sanders campaign. I feel like it was not in any way unclear to the leaders in the party what the young people in the party wanted, what direction they were trying to push that they wanted the party to move in. So if, you know, it's not like that message has been obscured, but I guess the party has got to figure out if it can actually get it together and do that and move in that direction.
I just wonder, I mean, if I were the Democrats, the current Democrats, and things were arrayed the way they are now, my solution to that problem would be to find a way to more effectively market myself to those people and not really change. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, the Democrats have been very good at marketing over the years. They've marketed lots of different politicians, and that's what I worry about, is that they'll find a way to sell it better but not actually change, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'll see. You're right. It could go the other way, too.
Of course, then we could also just have, you know, a little financial crisis or some moderate recession and everything will just go to hell. I mean, if things are as bad as they are now while during a you know, at least a technical recovery.
Yeah, it could be something like that, you know. And then, look, this is what happened after the financial crisis too, is you had all these people who were in foreclosure, who were losing their houses, who had their savings wiped out, and for the people in power, the problem went away as soon as the stock market recovered,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't feel the pain. You know, there was lingering pain for everybody else, but for people who mattered, you know, the problem was pretty much resolved as soon as they stopped the bleeding with the bailouts and all mm-hmm. that. So this is just sort of symptomatic of this divide between the electorate and politicians.
And people forget that the whole Tea Party thing, I mean, it was very well co-opted by the Republican Party leadership, but and the, you know, sort of existing conservative movement infrastructure. But there was some polling data that came out, you know, as late as 2010, where a majority of people who identified as Tea Partiers thought the government wasn't doing enough to provide financial aid to people facing foreclosure. And it's now discussed as this big anti-government movement. But you can see there was real unrest over what was materially happening in the economy with these people. And we just sort of shrugged it off, like, oh, I guess it'll work out eventually. And we started talking, at least in D.C., we started talking about, you know, politics as usual.
Yeah, no, you're right. That's exactly what God, who was that that Bush speechwriter, David Frum, who was mm-hmm. writing about earlier this year in the Atlantic. He was saying, you know, there were all these signs that this was out there during the Tea Party movement, during the Mitt Romney election. There were signs that the Republican electorate wanted the party to do more for ordinary working class people, and instead they just got more of the same deregulations, cutting taxes, trickle down supply side economics.
Mm-hmm.
Like they thought that was going to, you know, resonate with people at a time of real economic difficulty. It's just delusional, right? I mean,
right.
It's just weird to me that they couldn't see it. Trump shouldn't be a surprise in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully people can see it for the next couple of years so we don't go completely to hell. But Matt Taibbi, thanks so much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks a lot, Zach. Take care.
We'll be right back.
Hey, everybody. I just want to take the time to thank all of you for listening to this podcast. And I wanted to let you know that you can help us grow this podcast and grow the audience that you're a part of. Just go to iTunes and subscribe to So That Happened and leave a rating while you're there to let us know how we're doing. Doing so will help other people find us and allow this audience to grow and this podcast to flourish and become even better. So thanks very much for helping us out and for always being here for us.
And we're back. I'm Zach Carter, joined as usual by
Arthur Delaney.
And we have a very special guest on the phone today. He is a professor emeritus of history at the University of Wisconsin and the author of Woodrow Wilson, which coincidentally is a biography of Woodrow Wilson, who was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Please welcome to the show John Milton Cooper, Jr.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So at the DNC this year, at the convention, Tim Kaine gave a speech where he mentioned a guy who doesn't often come up, I think, at least over the last decade or so, in discussions of the Democratic Party's legacy. He talked about Woodrow Wilson. And usually I think Democrats trace their history back to FDR. They talk about Lyndon Johnson. They try to figure out what to do with Bill Clinton. And then Barack Obama is good again. But he talked about Wilson, and you wrote, you know, an 800-page biography of this guy. You've been a scholar who's followed him his whole life. Where does Wilson fit into this sort of broader party history?
Well, I think he fits in very, very well, essentially. Look, the modern Democratic Party really began 120 years ago with William Jennings Bryan's nomination for the Democrats in 1896. That's when they shucked off being the party of state rights, limited government, that kind of thing. In fact, you know, we had a big horse laugh, was it earlier this year, when Gail Collins made a big horse laugh out of Mike Huckabee going back to Grover Cleveland and praising him for what he'd done in vetoing aid to farmers and things like that. You know, sure, it was funny, but as a matter of fact, I think Huckabee was exactly right. The present-day Republican Party, with this small government, but really anti-government thrust of theirs, really, those were the Democrats. Those were the Democrats of the Civil War and post-Civil War era. And Grover Cleveland was their champion. Of course, he was their only president between Buchanan and Wilson. But that's what the Democrats were. And in 1896, they sloughed it off. In fact, I'm surprised that more people haven't made comparisons with Trump today and Bryan, although they're very, very different people. Because what happened was there were populists, and literally, I mean, the People's Party, the populists with a capital P, had this advanced program of particularly economic reform, getting the federal government involved in the economy, antitrust, the currency, railroad regulation, these kind of financial regulation, these kinds of things. And what the Democrats did, a significant number of them, particularly from the South and the West, basically swallowed the populists and didn't exactly kick the Cleveland Democrats out of the party, but they just shouldered them aside. And that's when the Democrats essentially became the party of the have-nots, more economic have-nots than social have-nots. I mean, that would be a problem. And okay, they lost. They lost big in 1896. It's kind of one of the great oddities today is that the two parties have really flipped their constituencies. The present-day blue states were the McKinley. That was the Republican coalition, which there were enough states and enough population to give them one very solid lock on the presidency in Congress, which, with the one interruption of Wilson, lasted until the early 1930s, and certainly the strongest hold a party has ever had on the presidency. But one thing, and I'll quit yakking so much, but the irony is that it was really the losers in 1896 who set the political agenda for the next 25 years. Currency reform, antitrust, regulation, all these kinds of things. And Wilson's the guy who brings it to fruition. I mean, essentially, if given an analogy, he is to Bryan what Reagan was to Goldwater. Notice the man who came in 16 years later and really fulfilled the agenda.
Professor Cooper, your biography of Wilson has been billed as bringing him back, basically, maybe in the way that we've seen Alexander Hamilton brought back by a Broadway musical.
I'd love to have a Broadway show. You got anybody who can do that for
me? Well, first, to get it going, the Broadway show, catch us up a little bit on some of the very simple, basic facts about what Wilson achieved when he was president.
Well, look, the three great legislative presidents of the 20th century, and maybe of all American history, were Franklin Roosevelt, of course, the New Deal.
New Deal.
Right. Lyndon Johnson, Great Society, and Woodrow Wilson, the New Freedom. Federal Reserve, income tax, first federal aid to farmers, first national labor legislation, a bill to prohibit child labor. The Supreme Court struck that down later. Louis Brandeis to the Supreme Court. I mean, it's really a remarkable legislative record. And if you want to look at it, Wilson did not have the advantages going for him that that FDR and LBJ did. I mean, FDR had a national emergency, the worst national emergency since the Civil War, the Depression, and he had a blank check from Congress. LBJ had spent his entire adult life on Capitol Hill. He knew it in and out. He mastered the Senate, and he could capitalize, of course, on the wave of national remorse with Kennedy's assassination. Wilson had a good wind at his political back, too, for progressivism, but this guy was only two years removed from private life. 2 years before he became president of the U.S., he had been president of Princeton University. In between, he was governor of New Jersey and did a spectacular job at that. But, you know, he didn't have the same sort of extrinsic advantages that the other two did.
Well, so, Professor, he accomplishes all of this stuff. But I feel like, you know, until the last few years, the reputation that he had was someone who was just an incorrigible racist.
Bill seems to have that reputation, doesn't he, with the latest stuff at Princeton, especially where they're trying to, there was an effort to try to remove his name from some things. Yeah.
So how does that fit into, I mean, this image of him as a progressive reformer on economic issues, but, you know, trying to segregate the federal workforce? I mean, how does that fit together?
Well, I wish I could say it's a terrible contradiction, but it's not. If you look at the major white politicians of that period, there's only one or two that you can point to who were really any good on matters of racial justice. What we have there, the South had regained control of the South. They got their solid South. And basically, as far as the white North was concerned, well, let them have it. Race is a Southern problem. We just as soon forget about it and ignore it. Now, one of the strange things is that with Wilson, people say, oh, well, he was a Southerner. It's quite true. Mm-hmm. He was born in Virginia, and then he was raised in Georgia and South Carolina. But he spent his entire adult life in the North. His attitudes were much more the attitudes of white Northerners at that time, which were, they considered race kind of a pesky distraction from other things and something that would take care of itself one way or the other. I mean, he was different from his Southern relatives even because, for white Southerners, race was always lurking there in the background, something they were always hyper alert. To anything that might threaten their racial hegemony. And frankly, there just wasn't much. I mean, the civil rights movement had just barely gotten started when Wilson became president.
Well, let's talk about his foreign policy legacy here before we've got to go, because I think that's what people, when I was in middle school and I had a middle school professor or teacher who just loved, adored Woodrow Wilson, she talked about the League of Nations a lot. What was he pushing for, and are there echoes of that in international institutions that exist today?
Well, people want to say that the UN is the successor to the League of Nations, and in many ways that's how it was sold, particularly in World War II. You know, Wilson, a lot of it in this country was, let's make it up to Wilson. You know, we didn't heed his warning while he was alive. You know, he wanted to take us into the League of Nations. He created the League of Nations and wanted to take us in, and wanted it to be an international body that would prevent major wars. Well, we didn't go in, and sure enough, there was a major war. So the UN was sold, or at least a lot of people sold themselves on it as doing it right this time. Actually, the United Nations is a much weaker organization than the League of Nations was designed to be. The League of Nations was a true collective security organization. Mm-hmm. If you want to look to true collective security organizations now, I think you'd look to NATO. You look to NATO and you look to, in some ways, some aspects of the European Union. In other words, those are the kinds of things where they really can put some clout, some force, different kinds of force. It can be economic sanctions. That was the preferred thing. It was the preferred thing then too. But, you know, the last resort can be military force, which the UN can do it. It did it in Korea, but that was under very peculiar circumstances. And basically it's not designed for that. But, But Wilson, in some ways, I think the kind of world we face today is much more like the world that Wilson was trying to deal with at the end of World War One, and there were just a lot of disorder and chaos and ferment, especially in what we now would call the Third World.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. That was what he was trying to deal with, and by and large, I don't think he's honored all that much in foreign policy. There's this while there that George W. Bush was called Woodrow Wilson on steroids. In other words, he was.
Oh dear.
Yeah. That, which was in some ways was unfair to both of them because Wilson was not a great. He was a democracy promoter in the sense that he was glad to see it promoted, and he thought that that would be good for the world. But he was very clear that he did not. We couldn't force democracy on other people that didn't want it.
Well, John Milton Cooper, we got to end it there. There are time limits on these podcasts, but this is all really fascinating. Your book is called, one of your many books is called Woodrow Wilson. It's a fascinating biography, and we strongly recommend it to all of our listeners. Thanks so much for joining us.
And we'll look for the musical next year.
We'll all get tickets for it, right?
Yeah.
So that's what happened this week. I'm Jason Linkins. This week we were joined by historian and author John Cooper Miller Jr., Rolling Stone columnist Matt Taibbi, and Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, and Lauren Weber. So That Happened is available on iTunes at itunes.com/sothathappened. Check out the whole family of Huffington Post podcasts in the iTunes store. And while you're there, subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, please send us an email at sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Thanks to all of you for listening. We miss you already.